Welcome to the InnovaBus podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't yet joined our wonderful Flywheel Nation community, go to flywheelnation.com and join in the podcast conversations. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast. Welcome to today's episode of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we delve into the transformative power of the stories we tell ourselves. Joining us is Steve McCready, a masterful coach and therapist whose expertise in rewriting personal narratives offers a beacon of hope and direction. In business and in life, the tales we believe about our capabilities often define our limits. Today, Steve will share actionable strategies that illuminate our path to not only navigate the complexities of self-doubt and self-imposed boundaries, but to shatter them. His approach provides the light you need to see beyond the immediate challenges, enabling you to emerge empowered and renewed. Tune in as we explore how transforming your narrative can dramatically enhance your professional achievements and personal happiness, leaving you inspired and eager to rewrite the script of your life. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really thrilled to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today, all the way from Sacramento in California, Steve McCready. Steve is a transformative coach and therapist with a unique background that spans IT, psychotherapy, and ultimately coaching. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Steve. It's a real privilege to have you here as my guest.
Well, Jürgen, thank you, and thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, me too. Now, you run a successful coaching practice, but you also share insights about how the stories that we tell ourselves, that we kind of live in, how they can either hold us back or propel us forward in both business and life. And I'm really looking forward to explore your innovative approaches to overcoming challenges, to transform relationships, and to really understand those stories and use them in business, as well as, change the story where we need to. So before we tap into all of those things, what's the impact you're hoping to make in the world, Steve?
So my goal is to help others be able to do bigger and more powerful things, to basically be able to release the blocks and obstacles that are getting in the way of being able to do what they're capable of. And so coaching is a great vehicle that allows me to do that for folks who are doing important and innovative work anywhere in the world.
And one of the things I find in the era of coaching and mentoring, particularly satisfying is when you have an impact on one person, then that impact is magnified, isn't it? Because that person kind of achieves more as a result of something that you've enabled them to do. And that person might enable a whole bunch of other people to do more as well. So it's kind of a ripple effect.
I think that it's one of those things that I occasionally have to remind myself of. But I have every now and then I get reminded of it because I'll hear a story from a client or a former client about something that happened as a result of something they learned from our work, or something that I shared with them that they shared with someone else that that person then used that had some effect. And it's like, you know, this person I'll never meet and don't know who was able to benefit from something I put out into the world. And that's pretty cool. And it is a way that, you know, we all really can, through taking action, make a difference. And I think it's building those sorts of things, lots of even small actions that can really have over time and space a very big and powerful effect. And I think keeping that in mind can help us to be really, I think, to accept that our work is important and really see that even sometimes doing what we might feel like are, you know, small things like, oh, this doesn't really matter, or this isn't really moving the needle. It's like, maybe not. It's probably moving the needle more than you think, just not necessarily in ways you see or that are right in front of you.
Yes, that's a really important point. And I was just reminded, I'm involved in a Toastmasters group. And one of the things about Toastmasters is that there's sessions where you provide feedback, where one Toastmaster will provide feedback to another Toastmaster on their speech or on their, whatever they've done. And it's amazing. Sometimes somebody will get up and present a speech or say something, and they'll say, I remember some feedback that Jürgen gave to this other person, and so I'm going to apply that lesson. And I think, oh, okay, that's really interesting. Something that I sometimes don't even remember saying that in the feedback, but it's exactly what you said, that little thing that has an impact on a lot of people.
I think for all of us, if we can focus on just the idea of planting seeds, you know, we don't necessarily know if they'll sprout, where they'll sprout, or who they'll benefit if they do. But I think if we work on planting good seeds and doing that and continuing to do that, we can trust that there's going to be a positive impact that comes from it.
All right. Well, planting seeds is a good little transition point. I mentioned at the beginning that you have had an interesting background from IT going through psychotherapy and then ultimately to coaching. So what were some of the seeds or some of the triggers that shaped that path?
Well, I mean, obviously, yeah, it took me a while to figure out what I wanted to do when I grew up. and I mean, what it kind of comes down to is I... the end part of the story is that I was someone who, because of some of the situation and where I grew up in, with my parents got divorced when I was young. I did have contact with both of them, but I was primarily with my mother. She had some mental health challenges, some substance challenges. And as a result, I often was having to figure a lot of things out on my own. So I certainly didn't experience anything that would count as abuse or anything like that, or even really significant neglect in the traditional way of not being fed or not having a roof over my head. But I often didn't get a lot of support in figuring things out. And I really was on my own to figure out a lot about life. And as a kid, that doesn't necessarily go really well. And but I have seen, you know, in my coaching work, people who certainly didn't get support or guidance or feel alone in trying to figure out some of the problems. And so that particular challenge of not having had that really resonates with me because of my own experience. And I think that's part of why I ultimately ended up feeling called to doing the psychotherapy work and later the coaching. The IT was something that I got into more from a space of interest. I've always liked gadgets and technology. I think it's kind of cool and fun. And so that was an area after college that I gradually moved into because it was a place that I had interest and skill and had some connections. And so I was able to get work there. And while I was good at it, I found it very unfulfilling. I didn't find there to be a lot of meaning or a lot of substance in the work that I was doing. And that really didn't sit well with me, which led to kind of an early life or an early midlife career crisis or whatever you want to call it. And it was from that when I went, did some career counseling, did some therapy of my own, that I started to unpack things and really exploring different ideas, saw psychotherapy as an option that spoke very much to me, both from the being able to do meaningful work, having the autonomy that comes with it, being able to support and help people who were maybe under-supported and all of those things. So it made a lot of sense, actually, and was immediately so much more fulfilling to me to do. And then over time, the coaching has been kind of a pivot that has evolved as I've, one, had opportunities to work with people in different contexts, in the context of a business problem or other things where I've had people I helped with one issue and they're like, can you help me with this other thing too? And I'm like, sure, let's try it. Let's see. And when I got the chance to work with people in more of a business context or more of a bigger picture coaching type context, I found that that was even more powerful to me than the therapy work that I'd been doing because it felt very open and very powerful as far as being able to really help people do bigger and more powerful things. And so that's why over time I've worked more and more into doing that, where that's really my focus at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Fascinating journey. So helping people do those bigger and more powerful things, what are some of the most common things that are kind of blocking them from doing, from getting there on their own?
I think plenty of time it is, at some level, it comes down to these stories that we tell ourselves a lot of the time. We have these beliefs and these ideas that seem super true. They feel so real and so accurate, but they often are distorted to some degree. It's not that they're completely wrong. It's that they are inaccurate. They're distorted. And so that's one of the big things that I see that gets in the way. Sometimes there certainly are things too, where people have don't have a good understanding of certain types of tools or strategies or ways of approaching things. Like, you see people who think that the brute force method is the way to do anything in business. And it's just like grind, 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 push, 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 push. And it's not that that doesn't work. It's that that doesn't work in a sustainable fashion. Right. And so you see sometimes people trying strategies that they were either taught or that they've had modeled for them that just aren't workable. And so I see, you know, people between the, and it comes back to stories in their head about this is the way. And so there's always things where what they're seeing or what they believe doesn't actually align with what works. And so it's for me about helping them, one, to see that, and then two, to correct that with a story that is a more workable, more accurate story that they can then use as a starting point to driving their actions and their behaviors to build a more sustainable, workable, and effective path towards success.
Mm-hmm. So a lot around stories there, and I guess it's sounds like you broke it into kind of two types of stories, one being what I tell myself about me. So, for example, I'm no good at being creative. So right. I'm never going to come up with new ideas that are groundbreaking or whatever. So that's a common one I kind of sense with a lot of people. And then the other story, which is, here's this problem. This is the way I do this problem. This is the way everybody else does this problem. I'm going to do that problem. And yes, it's really hard. It's not working, but I'll just keep going and try to crash through the wall rather than maybe I need to try a different approach. So let's talk first about the I'm not good enough type story. I guess it comes back to in the world of, I don't know if this is psychotherapy, but in the world of human psychology, it's kind of like I'm not good enough, I'm not loved, I'm not worthy. They're the three common ones. So how do you tackle those sort of stories, or how do you identify them first? Because often they're totally unconscious, aren't they, in the person? And how do you then address them?
Right. Well, often, I mean, this is one of the primary reasons why we all need people in our world, whether it's a psychotherapist, whether it's a coach, whether it's a friend or a close advisor, who is able to see the stuff we don't see about us, about what we're doing, about whatever, and is able and willing to call it out in a way that we can hear, right? That's the first one. It's like, because there's just stuff we all have blind spots. For us as individuals, part of it is really coming to that acceptance that guess what? you don't see things as clearly as you think you do. Yeah. No matter how much you practice, you will never see things completely accurately. And that bothers the hell out of me. I really don't like that truth. But what I found is when I accept those truths and I surround myself with people who are good at seeing what I don't see and who come at that from a compassionate angle, I'm then able to get that. And that's often my job with my clients is saying, hey, I think you're missing this, or I think you're looking at things this way. And often a lot of these stories that we get caught up and fall into, as you've identified, some real common areas, right? And they show up with certain sorts of patterns of behavior or other types of phrases or words. And so what for me, it's often a thing of when I see something that looks like that, I'm going to start exploring it with them. I'm going to start asking them questions. Tell me more about that. When does that come up? When is that not there? And we're just going to explore. So my job is often about being super curious and asking people questions and encouraging people to look around, you know, their lives and their thoughts and explore and poke at that and then gently start to question and challenge it. Where does that idea come from? Is that always been true? Are there times where that's not true? And as we start to look differently, they start to see a more complete picture, right? It's like right now, so you can see, right, only what my camera is showing you. You can't see anything else, but there's all kinds of other stuff in the room, right? There's lights, there's music equipment, there's a window, and all of that is still part of this reality, but it's not available to your perspective. And really, you know, and that's I think a big part of how we do that is helping people do that. But we have to also help them understand that we're doing that from a place of care, concern, and support, not from a place of basically being like, hey, you're delusional, get over it, right? We have to be really, and that piece of building that connection and that trust that I'm going to share difficult truths with you and uncomfortable truths, but I'm doing it from a place of care and concern, not from a place of judgment. You know,
yeah,
that connection's fundamental to the work working.
That's a really valid point, is eliminating the judgment. Because there is another example. I mean, you shared the example of I don't see your window, I don't see your lights, and yet they're there. It's part of the reality. But the other example, we're having a conversation about football or soccer, as some know it, earlier, and because your daughter's about to head to practice. And if you, and this is true of any sport, if you take your friend to the sport and you're supporting opposing teams, you can view exactly the same event happening on the field, and yet depending on which side you're supporting and what exactly happens, you have totally opposing views, right? In particular, if there's a decision made by the referee about an offside or a foul, that wasn't a foul. What do you mean?
Like, how can that ref simultaneously be both the best and the worst ref ever? Oh, I think that's a great example because it really shows how our beliefs, our stories, our priorities, and our focus further color things, right? This is that whole idea of confirmation bias. If we believe a certain thing, it acts as a filter that effectively colors, distorts, and limits everything that comes in. And unless we are really working to be aware of that or have, again, people to help us be aware of that, we run the risk of developing what can be some pretty severe blind spots. And in business, that can really be a recipe for failure. And in life, it can also be a recipe for not only failure, but things like burnout, failed relationships, all kinds of problems.
Yeah, that's right. And it's great you brought up that filter because the example of the sporting thing is very much along the lines of, you know, the belief, okay, I support this side, so that's going to be my filter. I'm going to be very sympathetic to any discretion that my side might do in terms and be critical of the referee when he makes a line ball decision that goes against my side, but I'm going to be very supportive of him when he makes a line ball decision that supports. So and it's all about the filter that I've placed in front of me. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and that's, again, it's one of those things that like is such a important part for me of my work is helping people become more aware of that filter and learn how to see it. And the thing is, we all have places where we tend to distort things more severely or not as well. And so like, I mean, an example I might use here as a metaphor, which will only make sense to people who are photographers and kind of serious about it. Mm-hmm. But if you look at like for cameras, like mirrorless cameras or interchangeable lens cameras, certain lenses tend to have common characteristics where they will, for example, tend to be a little blurry in this upper right corner of the image and whatever. Mm-hmm. And so there's common distortions. We are like that. We all have our own common distortions. We will tend to interpret certain things in more of a certain way. And that is an area where we can learn that we have these tendencies and we can learn to take our default response and kind of go, hang on a second. It's probably actually not quite that bad, or it's probably worse than that because we're minimizing it and we tend to minimize things. And, you know, learning that is so important because it helps us break patterns like of making the same mistake again and again and again. When we start to learn, that's often because of some distortion we have in how we believe things or how we look at things. Yeah. We can then work on developing corrective mechanisms for how to interpret things while we work on ways of getting clearer about our seeing.
Yeah, and it does require a fair amount of self-awareness, though, doesn't it, to sort of recognize those patterns. Am I falling into a pattern again? And you mentioned, you know, the behavior is one thing, and sometimes people call out the behavior, but they don't, and they do it in a confronting way, and that's right. That's where it threatens the relationship, right? So it's different to what you're talking about in terms of creating a safe space, not making judgments, saying, hey, are you sure you're not overlooking something here, or why is this different to that other situation where perhaps the view might be different? Mm.
Just really helping them understand. You know, there's so many ways we can convey intent, both through our word choice, through our tone, and over time in relationship, people come to develop a certain degree of understanding or trust, right? Clients I've been working with for longer, I can be a little more blunt with them because they know that I'm coming from this positive place. And so I can be a little bit more like, that's not going to work there. Or, hey, I think you're doing this thing again, you know, and they hear it in the way that it's intended. Yeah. And I can, again, curate the tone that I use with that. So, but it is really, I think that's a tricky thing. And I think in any of these sorts of relationships, the importance of the relationship and the connection in it working is a thing that gets, I think, often under-recognized. In the world of psychotherapy, they actually have come to understand that pretty well, that the connection between the therapist and client is a huge factor in positive outcomes. But I think in places like coaching or other spots, I don't know how well it's been studied, and so it may not be as well understood. But at the end of the day, it's fundamental because, again, if you don't trust somebody, if they don't feel safe, your willingness to value their perspective and their information is going to be hugely impacted.
Yes, it is really important to really build on that relationship and maintain it. And then, as you say, you can almost go lighthearted and still call out directly, which I know my business coach has a knack for doing that. So, you know, she'll kind of like call me out if I'm falling into a pattern or something in a way that's, you're doing it again, but it's like there might be an expression or a term and it'll like, we'll just burst out laughing.
Right.
And not take it seriously. But at the same time, I've got that indicator. Oh, okay. Yeah, actually, I am falling into that pattern. Yeah. Or something is, you know, I'm kind of building roadblocks in my own way again.
Yeah. And I think when we can get more aware too, right, we have these patterns and recognize that it's easy when we keep struggling with a certain thing, whatever it might happen to be. Like for me, it might be being too optimistic about an outcome, which is a thing I've been known to fall prey to. And it's easy if we're not careful to lapse into self-criticism around that, right? Oh my God, why can't you learn? Why are you still so stupid? All of that kind of stuff, which just will not help you in any way, shape, or form. And when we can instead recognize that may just be a thing that we're vulnerable to and find a way when it comes up to just be like, okay, here I am again. again, the more we can be self-accepting around our humanness and our imperfections, which doesn't mean we don't keep working on improving them and overcoming them. It just means we allow ourselves to be human. It also makes it a lot easier to take in that feedback because it's less threatening to our identity. Mm. It's like, yeah, okay, there is that thing again. And that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with me. It just means that's one of the bigger struggle areas of me, for me as a human.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, because I think that's a really important point. And I wonder how much of that kind of all comes into the same thing. So I often say to myself, or often say out loud, in fact, why didn't I? You know, there'll be a light bulb goes off in my head, and I'll feel like, oh, I should have known that. Boy, am I a slow learner. So I will tell myself that. So that's a story I tell myself, and it's obviously unconscious because I express it consciously quite a lot. And yet, and so if somebody's giving me feedback again, you know, sometimes you're the 10th person that said that. I ignored the other 9. So, okay, there it is again. You know, it takes me some time to take this stuff on board. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm telling myself I'm a slow learner, so I'm ignoring feedback that might be consistent until it gets to the point where the repetition overwhelms the story that I'm telling myself. And yet, totally. If we take the approach of forgive yourself for whatever that negative story is, you know, whether I'm a slow learner or not doesn't really matter, mm-hmm. Because maybe it's completely different. Maybe it's like these light bulb moments are actually magic, and other people build up to that very slowly, and so they don't realize they're learning stuff, whereas for me it's kind of it's being absorbed unconsciously, and then all of a sudden there's this big jump. So maybe I'm a staged learner or whatever the story might be.
Right. And when we figure out what is a better way of describing it, that is also useful because then we can replace the story. Even if it's a thing of saying, you know, like, again, I have the way that I learn is, you know, in more of a staged process, or it might be, I don't learn as quickly as I would like to, or any, whatever kind of thing it is, but finding a way that we can take what's happening and describe it so we have a story that is more accurate, number one, but number two, more workable. Like the story, for example, I'm not creative, is a problematic story. It's a fixed mindset belief, right? Referring to Carol Dweck's work versus a growth mindset, which might be, I don't have a lot of practice at being creative, or I haven't had any formal training in creativity, or I don't feel good about my creative abilities, but I would like to improve them, and it's something I'm going to work on, right? That's still acknowledging your what might be a real limitation about where you are, but it's doing so in a more open way where you're creating possibility, you're creating a path, you're opening a door to change versus, I'm just not creative, which is closing and locking the door.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. And I think that creative one is such a great example. I use that all the time. When I'm speaking to people and if I hear, and I mean, I used to hear this a lot in my corporate career because I was in a science background, and whilst I ended up in marketing and managing people, which is a lot more on the softer skill set side of the spectrum than the sciences, I tended to deal with a lot of scientists and engineers, and innovation was always a big theme in my whole corporate career, and yet a lot of people would say, well, I'm not creative. And right. I challenged that all the time, and I said, well, look, the assumption was that they felt creative was somebody that could write music or somebody that could write stories or that some novels or books or fiction books or somebody that could paint pictures or draw sketches that were accepted as this is really good. And I said, look, I'm probably the world's worst stick figure drawer. You wouldn't even recognize my stick figures as stick figures. I said, but I still consider myself creative. But even if you think about it from an artistic point of view, I've been photographing since ever since I can remember. I mean, I sort of don't even remember not having a camera and not taking photographs. And I say, I think I've got a good, an eye for what makes a good photograph. At least I think it's a good photograph. And I get some feedback on many of my photographs that they're good photographs, that people like them. And I say, well, that's creative. And I make that. I can write a blog post. That's creative. I can build a website. That's creative, because the content that goes in there is something that I've created. It's not something that sort of magically appeared somewhere. And I talked to the people in the corporate world. A lot of them were research scientists. I said, you guys have come up with ideas. You guys are working on this product that wasn't there before. You're creative. So, and yeah, it's that I think that's a real good example of a story where we take kind of one little corner snapshot, and that becomes a gross generalization that ends up being a barrier.
It's a huge barrier, and I think you make great points of it. It's like creativity is nothing other than taking some things. I mean, one way example is taking some things and mixing them in a new and different way, which can be taking any number of forms. It can be looking at it from a different angle or perspective. It can be highlighting a certain part versus another part. It can be, you know, so many different things. And photography is a great example, because you can take 10 photographers, have them photograph the same thing, and come up with 10 radically different looking photographs. Yeah. You know, and that's actually one of the fun things about photography, is taking a intentional point of view and playing with different perspectives and points of view. And in photography, when we're, you know, it's something we're practicing, you're often being more thoughtful and intentional about that. When we are living life and doing business, we're still taking points of view in choosing how we look at things, but we're often not conscious of them. Right. And it's becoming conscious of them and being really intentional about selecting the point of view we want to choose creates a lot of power for us. And it also opens things up for possibility and change, as does, coming back to what you were saying with creativity and how it gets looked at, making sure we're being careful about our definitions. Right? Because the idea, and I sometimes will do that. I'll look up words. I'll be like, what is the actual definition of the word? And I'll ask people, like, well, what do you mean when you say that? And then we'll kind of poke at it and see if there might be some ways in which they're unintentionally limiting the definition. And creativity is one that people, they do, like, well, I'm not like writing songs or painting pictures or what have you. And it's like, that doesn't mean you're not being creative. You can be incredibly creative with very basic and mundane things. That's not really creativity. You know what creativity is about? It's about creating, about figuring out different ways of looking at intermixing, building, or making things. So,
Yeah, and language is such an important part of that, because I in German there's a word that I guess it loosely translates to resourcefulness. We use it a lot because, particularly when our kids were growing up, kids are great at solving problems. So they'd sort of encounter some, we'd watch them and they'd encounter some problem or issue, a little with the toy they were playing or something, and they'd overcome it. They'd kind of do something and solve the issue they were having. But how they did it was like completely foreign to what we would have done. But right. Our response would always be, and there's a saying in German that's a kind of little poetic rhyme, little alliteration that basically means like whoever's not resourceful is lost. And so I like the word resourceful in this context, because I think anyone that is resourceful internally when they're faced with some sort of problem, and that may only be a tiny little problem, like I've locked myself out of the house today, how do I get back in? That to me is creativity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely, that's creativity. And I think the mix of resourcefulness and resilience or persistence or whatever you want to call it is where a lot of great innovation comes from. People classically give the example of Thomas Edison and the light bulb, and it's like, yeah, right. He had to keep trying new things, keep trying different ideas and whatever, and then be persistent enough to keep doing it. And when you mix those two things, right, a determination to keep going and a willingness to keep trying different stuff until you figure it out, that will solve a heck of a lot of problems in time.
All right. One of the things that you do talk about is embracing failure. And I think that leads on nicely to that, which is, you know, the Thomas Edison example, because I think one of the quotes that are attributed to him was that he didn't, was that Edison or was that, anyway, yeah. There's a quote that goes, I haven't failed 1,000 times. I've discovered 1,000 ways it doesn't work, right?
Right.
Which is a great reframe. So what's, the classic way of failure is we're almost taught at school that it's a bad thing, right? And we've got to avoid it at all costs. And so we end up not taking risks where we can avoid it, which is a big problem in the entrepreneurship game, because just starting a business is a risk in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And there's risks we have to take all the time so that we get some sort of payoff. Now, that doesn't mean to say we should be just, you know, jumping off the cliff without a parachute, but
right.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit more about this whole relationship with failure.
Sure. I think that one is, it is unfortunately in our world that is way too achievement focused and way too like achievement oriented, without recognizing how many factors contribute to some of those achievements. We are set up for identifying ourselves as a success or failure based on our ventures. And I think that that's a dangerous connection that we have to work to separate. And sure, we also do want to be careful, as you pointed out. It's like, don't jump off the cliff without a parachute or without knowing, you know, having a hang glider or whatever it is that you need. Make sure when you're taking risks and doing things that could fail, that you have a means and a plan to recover from the failure. Right? Because there are obviously some failures that can be literally or figuratively fatal. And that's something you want to watch out for. But many, if not most failures, are much less fatal or much more recoverable than we often give them credit for. But when we get focused, again, speaking of perspective, on all of the things we did wrong, of how, you know, whatever, how inadequate we are, how uncreative we were, how lazy, whatever, you know, story we want to build about that. What we do is we stop paying attention to the fact that we have a fairly large data set here that we can utilize, right? What are the things that we did? What are the things that happened in response to what we did? What kind of inferences can we make? What kind of assumptions that we, you know, can we make? Do we have other similar experiences we can draw from that? Can we make some guesses or develop some hypotheses about what we can do going forward? And when we do that, we then set the stage for being able to develop an iterative process that builds towards something. But to be able to, again, do that, we have to have a very different perspective on what does it mean that we failed here or that this thing didn't work or whatever term. And I like to avoid the word failure just because it has so much baggage around it.
Yeah.
But if people want to just redefine it for themselves, I think that's fine too, you know, and then really just get to a point where we go, okay, that didn't work out. And what can I learn from that? And how do I use that going forward? And the more we understand that, again, who we are is less about the outcomes we get and more about the efforts we make, I think, number one. And number two, if we're thoughtful about the endeavors we try so that we don't get ourselves into a situation where a failure really is unrecoverable, then failure becomes much less of a big deal. But to get there, this is one of those things that it's virtually impossible to convince yourself of this. Mm-hmm. And I think often you have to do it by doing things and experiencing failure in a way that you know is safe, right? So this is a setting up any kind of, you can do fun games of this. I used to have people, I still do it on occasion, actually. We'll have clients, I'll be like, I want you to go do something that you suck at, that you're really bad at. And I want you to go be bad at it. And the goal is in fact, to just go be bad at it. And then pay attention to your feelings. And where are those coming from? Why, you know, what are you telling yourself and whatever? Because often we think like, I should be able to do all of these things perfectly from the get-go.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah.
Why? Why? I mean, you know, like kids, going back to kids, they don't expect necessarily that they can just do things from the get-go. They just kind of poke at it and keep working at it and trying to figure it out until they figure it out. Once all of us were failures at walking.
Mm. Yeah, so. Exactly right. And I mean, this is where I come back to my science philosophy in some ways, and I say, well, okay, this is an experiment, and here's my hypothesis. And I, whilst my ego will say, well, it'd be great if, well done, my hypothesis worked out, but I know full well that until I do the experiment, I won't know. And there's right. Probably statistically about a 50% chance that the hypothesis will be proven incorrect. And when that happens in the scientific process, you say, okay, the hypothesis was proven incorrect. What did I learn? How do I adjust the hypothesis, or what experiment can I do now to learn more and then adapt the hypothesis? So I kind of keep reminding myself, if I ever fall into this trap, which I do quite a lot, to go back and do the science experiment. And yeah, I love the idea of coming up with a different word for failure, because I think one of the things, I mean, coming back to the quote of I've found 1,000 ways it didn't work, is there's got to be learning in all of that. And often when I'm mentoring somebody on something and they do something and ask for feedback, I kind of turn it around and say, well, how did you think you went? And it's interesting. Usually, well, you know, I sucked at this and this didn't work out the way I wanted and that. And I say, no, hang on, stop. I say, and I've kind of taught myself now that I have to ask the question differently. I said, okay, what did you do really well?
Right.
Yeah. What worked? What were you pleased with? And focus on those things. And I say, and okay, let those sit for 24 hours and then we'll come back and look at the stuff that you might want to improve on, because you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, right? You want to keep the good stuff. When you do these reframes or change your approach, you want to make sure you're keeping the things that are working.
It's essential to, and in fact, so this is, here's a really important point to note about the brain. So this is, I'm going to take this line from Daniel Siegel, who's a prominent neuroscientist. And his phrase is this. He says, the brain is Velcro for negative experiences and Teflon for positive ones. And there's a whole bunch of data when we look at other sorts of things as it relates to the brain. And it comes down to this. The brain needs to hold on. It thinks it does. It needs to hold on to the negative things, because that's kind of a survival wiring.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
That thing was awful. That thing was painful. That thing almost killed me. Those are good things to remember. That was a really nice, pleasant day. Is great, but it's not essential. That felt good. You don't need that for survival. And so the brain, unfortunately, in its desire to conserve energy and space, apparently, it tends to dump the good stuff. We have to balance that distortion of the brain out by bringing conscious awareness to the positive things. And it does not mean doing it at the expense of the negative ones. I'm definitely not a person for that. But we have to really understand how we inherently distort things and just work to provide correction. And I think what you're talking about of, hey, you know, what wins did you have? I like to do that too. I like to ask my clients, what wins did you have in the last week? And then how did you create them? Like, what did you do? What happened? Because that helps them to start seeing where their strengths are, where their successes are, and how they built them. That this, you know, is a thing that they had a contribution to. And that's an area that most of us tend not to look. We can always tell you what we screwed up and did wrong. In an hour, someone will ask me about this, the conversation, and I'll be like, oh, there was this part where I, you know, whatever, you know, but I probably won't be able to be like, oh, there was this one thing I said that was really thoughtful and insightful. I won't remember that either, because I have a human brain too.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. And it's interesting also when we ask for feedback, or when we give feedback as well, we kind of fall into the same trap, don't we? We kind of say, well, that was, or the best one I've seen, and this is one bit of feedback I always give to people. The best one I've seen is, oh, that was really good. But, you know, and by saying but, you've kind of told the brain, ignore everything I just said, and here comes the stuff you have to focus on.
Totally. We like either or. Black and white is clear and simple, right? We like it to be this simple thing. But I am increasingly try and lean into both and, right? Mm. How was it good and how could it be better, right?
Yeah.
How did it, you know, what was the problem and what was good about it? And really trying to incorporate both aspects. And but is kind of a, yeah, that doesn't really count because it's a like, let's again, the more we're getting an accurate and complete and clear picture, the more we have a good data set, the better the chance we have of being able to do something as powerful and productive as possible going forward.
Hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, I think it's a good point now to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. Otherwise, we'll keep talking for ages about this.
For sure.
We've probably only scratched the surface.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's the same five questions I ask of every guest, and the idea is you'll give us some really short, sharp, insightful answers that will inspire the listener to go and do something awesome as a result today.
Awesome.
You all set?
Let's do it.
All right. What's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Listen to themselves more and listen to others less.
Hmm. That's interesting. So become more self-aware. Is that what you mean?
I mean, it's innovation doesn't lie in what other people are doing, because if you look at that, you're just going to copy them. Mm. You know, if you take and listen to your own perspective on things, we're all unique. We're all also the same. It's kind of an interesting contradiction, I know. And if we are willing to look at our take on things and our perspective and to allow that out, there is a really good chance we're going to have some aspects of that are unique or are different. So I think that's a way that we can do that. That's also working on honoring and valuing ourselves more.
Mm, yeah, really good point. And it's one way of the filters that we talked about earlier of using those positively, right? Because we talked about the stories that we kind of construct based on the filters that we put our experiences through. And here's a way to apply those filters in a positive way where we can create something from us.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
All right. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
At the risk of repeating myself, I think it's for me of listening to myself and being, I'll say listening to myself, especially when it is something that goes against the status quo or the norm. Hmm. It allows me to do things. I mean, as an example, I started at the beginning of this year, I shifted to doing a daily email. And that is one of my primary means of promotion right now. And so it's like, I'm not all over social media and I'm not doing these emails, or they're not long. They're not really extensive and in depth. They're very short. They're intended to be short, snappy, quick ideas to give you something to take, think about, and move on with. And that's because that's the way I'm often most powerfully able to communicate ideas, I've found. It's not necessarily something a lot of other people do, but it's easy for me and it's something people appreciate. And my willingness to be like, okay, this is no one's idea of a best practice, but I'm going to do it anyway. This has worked pretty well. I've gotten a lot of nice positive feedback about it. So there you go.
Mm, fascinating. Yeah. It's interesting that you say that nobody's doing that or not many people are doing that, because I seem to be gravitating towards people that write daily emails. and yeah, I've got a bunch of people who I admire them for what they're doing, and I subscribe because they're sending me some valuable stuff every day. I struggle to keep up with reading it all, but and I certainly struggle with doing a weekly email, let alone a daily one.
It's an interesting practice. Once you do it more, it gets easier. But again, for me, these emails are short. They're almost always under 200 words, and often they're under 50 words. I'm giving you a couple sentences or a couple things. I mean, I work to get it refined to that, but the goal is I literally want it to be something that's going to take you less than a minute to read, because I know everyone's got too much email. So I just want to give you, again, here's some food for thought. It's kind of like an extended fortune cookie of sorts, but hopefully with something that's got a little bit more substance to it.
Yeah. Great. All right. What's a favorite resource you use most often?
So one of my most powerful and useful resources is mind mapping as a tool or as mm-hmm. a process. I have found nothing that is more useful and more effective for helping me get all the darn noise that seems to always be in my head, out of my head. So it's not just in there, you know, distracting me and making a bunch of noise, but two, it is such a powerful and useful tool to organize all of those thoughts. And from that, I find patterns, I find insights, all of those things. And so it's really, really powerful. And every now and then I drift away from it, but whenever I come back to it, I'm always like, oh my God, this is such a great tool. And it helps me, I think, almost more than anything in unpacking and organizing what's going on in my head and really in my world too.
I'm a keen mind mapping fan. I'm still sort of vacillating between kind of the digital platforms and not, and I haven't found anything that really works. I mean, you can kind of construct a nice mind map digitally, but it doesn't really do the same as writing down and organizing the mind map on paper, because it doesn't, I don't think it triggers the brain as much. But I'm looking forward to kind of some of these AI tools that can organize the random thoughts and actually build the connections where I might not even see them, and then as a start point for me.
Yeah, I think that's going to be interesting. And I haven't tried the thing of having other people look at my mind maps and get their insight on them, but that actually might be an interesting strategy, or I might have some work with some clients on that. Again, from the idea of getting a different perspective on things, but AI is going to do that as well, yeah. I'm sure.
Yeah, I used to lead international teams across many different countries and many different cultures and languages, of course. And we used to come together once a year to mm-hmm. brainstorm, build strategy and so on. And once I got proficient with mind mapping, and this is going back years because I saw Tony Buzan in person, so the guy who mm-hmm. kind of developed mind mapping. I saw him in person present, and that was what sold me. He taught me to juggle in 15 minutes. That was the exercise he did, and I thought, wow, that's quite brilliant. Yeah, you know? And that was part of the one day workshop. But when I applied this mind mapping in that group, and we did the mind map together, and all of a sudden the people, particularly the Japanese team, that, you know, because of their culture, they wouldn't speak out, they wouldn't challenge any ideas that anybody put forward, particularly the sort of higher level mm-hmm. than they were. So I was the kind of manager of the whole section. So they wouldn't challenge ideas that I put forward, or they would wait until I expressed an opinion until they expressed their opinion and so on. And I remember one time we'd built this mind map of the strategy, and it was the first time I sort of shared mind mapping with the others. And at the end, everybody sort of had a bit of a presentation to do on their take of the week we were together and what mm-hmm. What actions they were going to take back to their particular location or group. And when the Japanese team got up and did the presentation, I was just blown away because, you know, that was the first time where I sort of felt it deep inside that this crew was on board, they were engaged, and they were going to not just sort of sit back and do what they were told, but they're actually going to take some initiative. They're actually going to sort of speak up when they saw something that they thought was going off course on what we'd agreed and so on. And I thought, that's kind of the power of mind mapping, because it mm-hmm. sort of had broken down this barrier of communication, broken through the cultural barriers, broken through the language barriers, and broken through the hierarchy, the structural hierarchy that was there.
It's really cool. I suspect it, yeah, is a byproduct of its structure and how it's constructed that it does end up effectively breaking through those things, because it's so simple in one sense, but yet so powerful because of how it works. It's really just a great tool that I cannot recommend highly enough to folks who don't use it to play with it.
Yeah, excellent. All right, now what's the best way to keep a client on track?
So I think the best way to keep a client on track is to, one, make sure we know like where they're trying to go, and two, that we are touching base regularly to see where they are on their journey, right? Because we all drift off course from time to time. It's like an airplane flying from, you know, if I was to hop on an airplane from Sacramento to come visit you, it's like the plane's going to be off course most of the time, and the pilots are always making little course corrections, right? And so we've just got to have the regular check-ins. My clients, I tell them, you know, to ping me during the week if they're having a hard time with something between our calls. I might periodically check in with them. And so we've just got to make sure we've got a map and we're like, where are you? And if you're off course, what do we need to do to course correct?
Yeah. I love that aircraft metaphor. It's so powerful, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right. And what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
So I'm actually going to steal someone's answer. I was listening to your conversation with Kate earlier today, actually. And unfortunately, I was hearing her, you know, answer these questions. And she said, I think, you know, basically listen to and value yourself or whatever. And I was like, oh, damn it. That's my answer, too. Because again, it's really, you know, it's, I think, true. It's again, you have a way of seeing the world, a way of experiencing the world, a way of looking at things that's going to be, at least in some aspect or some aspects, unique or different. And within that, there lies a lot of power and potential. But a lot of the time, what I see is people don't put that stuff out there because they think, oh, no one cares, or, oh, everyone else has already thought of this, or, oh, you know, whatever it is. And those stories and those thoughts get in the way of putting it out there. And that's unfortunate. That's a real loss, you know, and that's one of the things that drives me in my work is I know so many people who have valuable insights, valuable ideas, things to contribute to the world, but they, for whatever reason, cannot get to that point of putting them out there. And it's often blocks that they've created for themselves or they've allowed to be there. And so really getting them to where they can turn inward and listen to and honor and value themselves is one of the most fundamental things that they can do to be able to break free of that.
Yeah, it's having some more self-awareness and a bit of self-confidence, I guess, that as long as it's not, cockiness.
Right.
Yeah, I was having a conversation on an earlier podcast episode today, and it was around this idea of we have stuff that we absolutely take for granted because it comes so naturally to us, we take for granted. And I've had this experience so often, and it's, it sort of always blows me away. And I thought, oh, there's another one that I just I'll be working with someone and I'll do something, and the other person will say, wow, how did you do that? Or show me how you did that. And I'm surprised, thinking, what do you mean? I don't even know what you're talking about. And that thing you just did there, and they'll explain to me what they're talking about. And I'd say, oh, doesn't everybody know that? It's kind of like, you know, right. It runs on autopilot for me. And there's so many of those little things that are hugely valuable to other people if we can appreciate that not everybody can do that on autopilot. People would pay huge amounts of money to do that or to learn how to do that, and to be able to be aware of that and then share that information, I think, is a huge, huge benefit.
Oh, I think probably everyone's had that experience. I certainly have. And it's an example of when we get focused on the wrong thing, we get in our own way and we end up not only hurting ourselves, but not hurting others, but at least limiting what we can do to help or serve others, right? Instead of going, what do I know that might be relevant to this issue? What do I know that might be of value here? What is my brain suggesting? And just trusting that, we go, oh, I probably shouldn't say this. Everyone already knows this. He'll think I'm stupid for saying that, right? Instead of, you know, and just putting it out there. And because sure enough, exactly. I can't tell you the number of times I've had that happen where I'm like thinking like, everyone knows this, right? And it turns out like, nope, not everyone knows it, including especially the person you're talking to who's going to benefit a lot from it because you chose to share it with them. So yeah, that's huge.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks, Steve. Thanks for getting us through the buzz round and for the conversation so far. It's been great. Where can people find out more about you and the work you do and maybe even get in touch to say thanks for what you've shared?
Yeah, absolutely. So best place is going to be my website, which is my name. So that's stevemccready.com, and that is mccready.com. So you can go there. If you want to get that daily email, it's just weekdays from me. You can sign up for that there on the homepage, or just send me a note. You can, link to my LinkedIn that way, you know, and you can connect with me on LinkedIn as well. That's another space where I can be found on occasion, but yeah, my website's probably the best place to start.
Excellent. And we'll include those links in the show notes, of course, as always. Now, as we wrap up, what action would you like our listener to take out of our conversation today, Steve?
The thing I would most like for everyone is to try and look at something that you have wanted to do, wished you could do, dreamed about doing, but had a story about why you couldn't do it. And I'd encourage you to find some willingness to go examine that story and question that story, or get some help from someone you care about or trust to get their take on it and re-examine whether or not that story is true and see, like, what would it be required for you to turn that story into something else? Because not only would you be doing a service to the world, but you would be making your own life that much bigger and that much more full. And if some people were to go and do that, the world would benefit, and that would just be really, really cool. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, wonderful. All right. Well, there we go. There's one to do a little bit of reflection and introspection and have a chat to some people that might be able to add perspective and then most importantly, take action on what you learn. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Steve, for our conversation today. I've really enjoyed this and really learned a lot about your perspective and your insights. So all the best for the future, and please do stay in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again for having me on. Always appreciate the opportunity to talk about this stuff and share it. I think it's such important and valuable stuff. And so if a few more people become aware of it and are able to take and do something with it, then that's great. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for listening. We'd love you to leave a review on this episode. It will help us to make the podcast better for you. Simply go to lovethepodcast.com/InnovaBuzz and pick your preferred platform. Remember to visit innovabiz.co/flywheel and secure your membership to the exclusive Flywheel Nation community, where you'll enjoy direct access to our incredible podcast guests, engaging meaningful conversations, and participate in connection events designed to elevate your business journey. Don't miss out. Join Flywheel Nation today. Tune in again to the next episodes of the Innova Buzz podcast, where we've got yet more fantastic guests lined up. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.